Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name's Paul Johnson. I'm the Vice Chancellor of La Trobe University, and I'm chairing this evening's seminar, the first of the 2009 Tertiary Education Policy Seminars that are being coordinated by the Centre for the Study of Higher Education and the L.H. Martin Institute for Higher Education and Management. Welcome to everyone here this evening. The first seminar is on the subject of the 2009 federal budget, what it means for tertiary education. At this point, I need just to alert you all, and some of you will have already spotted, if you know the speakers, that Michael Gallagher is indisposed today. It was found out, I think, at about 9 o'clock this morning that that he has flu, whether of the swine variety or otherwise, is unclear. But we're very grateful for Simon Marginson to have agreed to stand in and give us his views on the budget and what it means for tertiary education. Therefore, two speakers tonight are going to be Jeff Borland. Jeff is a professor in the Department of Economics here at the University of Melbourne, and he's one of Australia's foremost intellectuals in the area of economics. That esteem has recently led to Jeff being named as the next chair of Australian Studies at Harvard University, a position that he will be taking up next year, and he'll be in Harvard for a 12-month period. Simon Marginson is Professor of Higher Education in the Centre for the Study of Higher Education here at the University of Melbourne. He's held that position since 2006. He holds two ARC Discovery Grants and is a very well-known researcher in the area of higher education, an academic author, a public commentator, particularly on issues to do with higher education policy. So Jeff and Simon are extremely well positioned to give us their thoughts on the 2009 federal budget, a crucial moment, I think, for Australian higher education, because the budget fleshed out some, but by no means all, of the issues that the Deputy Prime Minister, Julia Gillard, and the Minister for Innovation and Science, Senator Kim Carr, had announced as the government's response to the Bradley Review, those announcements they initially made at the University's Australia meeting in Canberra in March. Quite, therefore, what the budget means for tertiary education, well, we will all have our own ideas. We'll hear from Jeff and Simon in a minute. I have to say, when I was in Canberra on budget night and listening to announcements as the Deputy Prime Minister and Senator Carr almost vied with each other to generate yet more billions of future commitments to the higher education sector, I wondered if it was all too good to be true. I guess we'll get some professional assessment of whether it is all too good to be true and whether there is any sting in the tail of the budget to come forward in future years. So thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for coming along. We'll hear both the speakers sequentially, and then we'll have about half an hour for discussion, and there will be a roving microphone for those who are at the far ends of the room to speak into.
Thanks very much, Paul. So I've called my talk Higher Education Commonwealth Budget an outsider's perspective, because I have to say, I guess, I'm not sort of someone who works continuously sort of in this area, and so I guess it's I'm giving you sort of a perspective of someone who's come along and knowing a little bit about sort of the higher education sector from working in it, and knowing a bit about the higher education sector from having done some research on it, give a perspective from that point of view on the budget. I guess a couple of weeks ago, the CSHE put on an excellent lunchtime session on the budget, which Simon also spoke at, with Andrew Norton. And so I guess given that Simon's now speaking, I've got to also sort of acknowledge that at a couple of points in the talk, you'll see that I've pinched some of the good bits from his talk a couple of weeks ago. So, yeah, we're very fortunate at University of Melbourne to have Andrew and Simon, who I guess I regard as sort of the two real sort of premier commentators on higher education in Australia. And you'll see that I'm not just saying that because I've actually used what they say in my talk as we go on. I thought, which one do I push, Michelle? Which bit?
That one?
Oh, okay, thanks. Okay. So I guess a lot of you would know pretty well what's in the budget, but just in case not, I guess my take is that the big things are, I guess, in terms of the places, higher education places, I guess introduction of what the government's calling a demand-driven system, where there are going to be sort of extra places to enable them, funded to enable them to reach the target of having to meet the Bradley Review target of places by 2025. A whole lot of sort of extra funding, so extra funding for infrastructure from the Education Investment Fund, the extra government-funded student places, loadings for students from low SES background, plus a partnership program with university to assist university in developing relationships with schools to sort of assist in bringing a larger proportion of low SES background students into universities. Gradual reintroduction of indexation of teaching funding. The promise of extra funding in the form of performance funding, so the idea that there'll be potentially 2.5% extra funding available for each university if it meets specified performance criteria. Extra funding for indirect costs of research, I guess, coming out of the Cutler Review of Innovation. So again, sort of, I guess, staged introduction of extra funding for research. Structural adjustment funding for regions. I guess probably the main thing that, at least looking in the newspaper, seems to have got attention about the budget lately, changes to the eligibility provisions for student income support. I guess in particular changes to the eligibility provisions relating to having done part-time work or having sort of achieved particular level of earnings or part-time work with particular level of earnings or continuous work for some period in the past. Another new system of regulation and accreditation for universities, or at least regulation, I guess accreditation is new, and reform to improve tertiary pathways. So there's quite a wide range of changes sort of involved in the budget, which I guess you'd be familiar with. The first sort of perspective I wanted to give on the budget, I guess, really relates to the level of expenditure that's provided. The last 5 years or so, I guess, I teach a subject in Australian economic history. And so I guess one of the perspectives I thought I could offer on the budget is, a perspective from Australia's economic history in terms of the importance of education. And so I guess I've called this sort of subsection A Rich Country on the Cheap, which is maybe another way of saying Donald Horne's expression of the lucky country. When you have people in education who are saying you should spend sort of more money on education, there's always the question of how do you make that credible, sort of? How do you establish that that's not special pleading? I was thinking that one way economists, I guess, are big into a subject called mechanism design, which is where you find out ways of getting people to tell the truth. And I was thinking that one way that maybe would be induced sort of truth-telling would be if you were willing to say, look, there should be more money for higher education or more money for education generally, and I'm happy for there to be no more money for the economics and commerce faculty at University of Melbourne. And I think my dean might kill me for sort of agreeing to that, but I think, you know, the issue of sort of extra funding for education, sort of there is so much evidence that it actually matters for Australia's economic performance, and so much evidence that it is important to provide extra funding for education that I think I'd be prepared to sign on the dotted line for that. That if it was a case of getting extra funding for education, you'd be prepared to say, okay, everyone else can get extra funding, but my area, I'm happy for my area not to. The other way, of course, you can sort of try and give an independent perspective on whether extra funding for education really matters is by looking at what people who are, you know, experts in studying that area say. And probably the two economists, economic historians, I guess, who've done most work on the role of education and economic growth recently are Claudia Gold and Lawrence Katz in the US. And so they have their have recently published a book on this. And so I chose a quote from that, which is where they say, at the end of the 20th century, almost all nations have discovered what America knew at the beginning of the 20th century. Human capital embodied in one's people is the most fundamental part of the wealth of nations. Other inputs increasingly can be acquired at world prices on global markets, but the efficiency of one's labour force rarely can. And so I guess what they're saying is, look, capital markets are global. We know that there's competition in global capital markets, which means that you can acquire sort of financing and capital at world prices. We know sort of, I guess, the resources Australia sells, prime products Australia sells, that those are generally traded on sort of world markets where there's competition. That means that you're trading sort of at world prices. But labour, human capital, is still the one, even sort of, I guess, we hear about sort of global markets for CEOs and things like that. But capital is, human capital is still one resource which really sort of hasn't displayed as great mobility and which just isn't traded on world markets to the same extent. So human capital is still really sort of, you know, the key resource that can provide nations with a comparative advantage. And of course, when we think of sort of human capital, we think of things like human capital expanding the range of tasks that a labour force can do, human capital increasing the level of efficiency with which those tasks are done, human capital making workers more adaptable to change, and human capital, of course, being a source of creativity and invention. Golden and Katz do sort of a review of a variety of evidence on sort of the role of human capital in affecting economic growth, and they estimate that if you look just at the 20th century, the growth in education attainment in the United States in that period accounted for about sort of 20% of productivity growth in the US during the 20th century, the century when the United States really became the dominant industrial power globally. And that 20% is really a lower bound on the role of education, because they do a growth decomposition sort of exercise where when they say 20%, that's just the direct effect of labour. And they say that once you take account of the fact that sort of more human capital is also likely to affect the quality of capital, physical infrastructure that's being used in an economy as well, that the effect sort of is likely to be much larger, and, you know, you're more likely to be talking about effects sort of over 50%. So education, I guess, from the from that work is something that was found to be incredibly important. To give a perspective on Australia, I guess the Australian sort of economic history, when you compare Australia against, as it often is, against other sort of settler economies, the United States, Canada, in particular, the sorts of the big thing that stands out by comparison with those economies is that those economies as well are economies where natural resources were important in the initial development and the fact that those countries became wealthy so quickly. But the thing that's notable about Australia is how persistent the strong role of natural resources in explaining economic growth has been. And so by natural resources, I mean sort of the mining industry today, but I also mean just the role of land and primary industries, pastoral, agricultural sector in the 19th century. And by comparison with the United States and Canada, sort of a much more limited role for productivity growth as a driver of overall economic growth. So yeah, we can expand our level of material well-being sort of in two ways, by increasing the amount of resources we're applying in production, so that is applying more labour, applying more land, applying more capital, or by getting more efficient in using the resources that we have. And so that's productivity growth. Australia's growth, by comparison with the United States and Canada, has been much more about increasing the amount of land we use, the amount of labour we use, the exploitation of natural resources, than it has been about productivity growth. The problem with that is that we know that there's been historical periods in the past when, where we've run out of resources, that's imposed a major constraint on economic growth in Australia. So I guess at the turn of the 19th, 20th century, Australia was the richest country in per capita terms in the world. Australia was richer than the United States. Australia was richer than any other country. In the early part of the 20th century, that position quickly eroded, sort of. Australia went from having about a 20% advantage on, say, United States and Canada to having about sort of 80, 90% of their levels of GDP per capita. And that basically stayed the situation sort of through to the 1970s and 80s. And, you know, essentially sort of when economic historians like Ian McLean at University of Adelaide, who's someone who's done a lot of work on this, have looked at that, they've concluded that one of the main, and potentially the main, explanation for why that's happened is that at the end of the 19th century, Australia ran out of land that was suitable for extra pastoral activity. That basically that was when Australia reached the limits of finding new land that could be used in the pastoral industry. And as well, around that time in the early 20th century, it was believed that Australia had essentially run out of mineral resources as well. So this was one thing that amazed me when I started learning about Australian economic history. But for a long time in the 20th century, it was actually believed that Australia wasn't very resource-rich in minerals. In fact, that's why sort of before World War II, there's the famous story about Pig Iron Bob Menzies being criticised for selling scrap iron to Japan. And the reason for that was that Australia was seen as having a shortage of mineral resources that could produce its own iron. So the period where Australia fell behind the United States, Canada, other countries in the world in terms of its GDP per capita was the period when Australia reached the limits of its growth in terms of being able to exploit land and natural resources in the same way that it had been up until that time. So the extent to which Australia relies on sort of using sort of its resources, mineral resources, land, is potentially a constraint on growth, whereas the experience of countries like the United States, which have relied more on increasing sort of education attainment, is that that's provided sort of a more sustainable basis for higher rates of growth in the long term. I just have another sort of feature there that making this point about in 1905, the ratio of labour productivity in Australia to the US was 105, so labour productivity in Australia was actually higher, but by 1961 had fallen to 73. And so there we're talking about sort of the century which is called the Golden and Cats, called the human capital century in America. This is the period when America first rapidly expands high school education, sort of 30 years before Australia does and quite a bit before a lot of other countries do as well. And then in the 1940s and 50s, the US has their higher education revolution, sort of, again, another sort of 30 years before Australia does. So if you're looking for explanations of why Australia's labour productivity fell consistently behind that of the US in the 20th century, I think a major explanation most economic historians would think would be education. And then when you look at sort of, so this comes from Bradley Review, sort of, I guess, Australia's sort of, at least in recent times, consistent record of sort of anemic expenditure on education, it makes the point that there seems to be significant scope for increased education. Boris Shedwin, who again has been sort of major Australian economic historian, had an article in the Australian Economic Review last year sort of surveying sources of competitive advantage in Australia in the 20th century, and he's basically saying that look, the basis for long-term economic growth in Australia in the future has to be high levels of investment in education. Just one extra perspective on that. There's some interesting work being done recently by Benjamin Jones, an economist at Northwestern University, where he describes what he calls the burden of knowledge. That is, that as the amount of knowledge we have globally increases, it means you have to know more to be able to extend knowledge more. So he has a nice analogy where he talks about often sort of the geniuses of the past talk about standing on the shoulder of other geniuses who came before them. And he said the problem for future geniuses is that it's going to take them a lot longer to climb up the back of the past geniuses to get to the shoulders of the past geniuses because of all the extra knowledge that there is around at the moment. And so he looks at data on Nobel Prize winners and also data on patents granted in the United States. And he finds that there's been significant increases in the age at first invention. So that is the age at which inventors first try to patent or first successfully patent an invention, and also significant increases in the extent of specialisation. So that is the likelihood that inventors jump between discipline fields in the patents that they put in, and significant increases in the size of the teams who are the names on the patent applications, even in the last 25 years. So he finds, for example, that just in the period since the early 1980s, the average age of people putting in patents to the US Patent Office has increased by 1 year in the last 25 years. When he looks at Nobel Prize winners, he finds that during the 20th century, the average age of Nobel Prize winners in science has actually increased by almost 6 years in the 20th century, sort of. So I guess I take this as saying that we really need to run or train longer to stay still. That the imperative for sort of investing in education is increasing as our knowledge increases. Against that, I guess when you look at the budget, certainly there's some increase in public expenditure, and I guess that could be regarded when you look at the history of the past 10 or 15 years as a notable achievement. That public expenditure, you know, it's amazing when you read the Bradley Review and see that public expenditure basically increased by zero sort of in that time from 95 to 05, and Commonwealth contributions to Commonwealth supported places decreasing in real terms, stuff like that. But it has to be noted as well that I guess the this budget, even though it spans a four-year future time horizon, comes nowhere near matching the Bradley Review recommendations. There's no 10% immediate increase, which was recommended, and there's only a slow introduction of indexation for teaching and funding for indirect costs of research. And the extra funding for the infrastructure, a lot of that actually involves a rundown of the amount of the education investment fund. And so this is the first point where I've pinched one of Simon's good parts from his previous talk, that Simon called it a budget of deferred gratification, that there's some gratification there, but a lot of it actually doesn't come till 2010-11, 2011-12. And even when you take that into account, Simon estimated in Australian Financial Review article that the eventual funding's only about 37% of the Bradley recommendations. The rest of the talk, I just wanted to take up a few particular sort of aspects of the budget that it seemed to me I could say something about. So one of the big ideas is this idea that there'll be 2.5% extra funding for universities that meet specified criteria that they agree with the Commonwealth government. And I guess I had a few points to talk about here. One is just sort of, do we need performance funding? And I guess I come from a background where of doing graduate study, sort of, I guess, in the United States, where this type of performance funding, I guess, would I think never be heard of. There, I think, you know, the way the system works is you have a strongly competitive system. You have sort of the leaders at universities. They want their universities to be best. You have the deans who want their faculties to be best. They know the way to do that is you go out and hire the best staff that you can, and you provide them with the best sort of resources you can, whether that's the infrastructure to work with, the graduate students that you have there, the amount of time that's available for doing research. And I guess, you know, we always look to sort of the United States as the benchmark in the quality of research that's being done. I mean, when you look at things like the Zhao Tong Index, the number of in universities that rank in the top 100 in the different discipline areas. Some of that's going to be to do with sort of population size. Some of it to do with, funding systems in the United States. But I think a lot of it sort of, it can't be explained by those things alone, and you have to look at things like the sort of competitive system that exists sort of in the United States. And so I guess the way I raise the issue of performance funding is just, yeah, I think there has to be a balance between regulation and trust in sort of leadership and competition. I guess if you have sort of a system where you think you've got good leaders in place in universities who are committed to achieving the goal of high quality sort of research and education, then there is sort of a question about, well, do we really need a system that's going to give sort of 2.5% extra funding and all the sort of regulation and system that's going to go with that to give out that amount of money, or should we just trust the system? Second point is, if you are going to have this system, what should the performance criteria cover? And so I guess this is not really something that's discussed in the budget, but in the Bradley Review, there are particular criteria mentioned. One thing that occurs to me about those criteria is, I guess we always, and I guess, you know, often economists are accused of being sort of the worst of this at all, but there is a temptation to sort of think that if you can measure it, then we should use it as a performance criteria. If it's more difficult to measure, then we don't want it as a performance criteria. And the thing that occurred to me, I guess, looking at the Bradley criteria, is that it says, oh, we're going to look at the CEQ, we're going to look at student engagement surveys, we're going to look at sort of teaching quality sort of measures from within the universities. I guess when I was sort of a head of department, I used to think about teaching performance as really having sort of two dimensions. It was about what you taught, and it was about how well you taught it. And it always seemed to me that students were the best people to ask about how well you were teaching. And so quality of teaching surveys have a really important role in that regard. CEQ has potentially important role in that regard. But you wouldn't necessarily ask the students if what you were teaching was right. If you wanted to know whether you were teaching an appropriate sort of curriculum in economics, if you're wanting to know whether you had a right honours program in economics, you wouldn't ask students about that. You'd seek peer review on that. And so I guess if we really are going to have a performance fund targeted at teaching, I think it's important that it doesn't just include what can be measured. I think it has to address both whether the material that's being taught is appropriate, which I think in the end you can often only get at by peer review, and maybe some measures which take account of student perceptions of the quality of teaching. Second issue is, are financial incentives enough? And I guess the big problem with just relying on these financial incentives is that, so if you don't meet the target, then you don't get the 2.5%, and then arguably you're in a worse position to try and improve in the future. I guess, again, my experience of being head of department at university is we certainly have incentives for good teaching these days. You know, we have criteria for being confirmed or being promoted that relate to getting particular levels on the quality of teaching surveys. But I guess, you know, we would get killed by human resources in the university if we were just saying, look, you meet that target or you don't, that's it. We have to provide a lot of support to people who aren't meeting those targets to be able to say, if you're actually going to act on those targets in the end and say, look, you haven't met the standards we wanted, you have to be providing a lot of mentoring, training, support to people who sort of aren't meeting those targets. So I would have thought that sort of that you don't just want to introduce a system like this cold, you maybe want to introduce the performance targets, look how people are going on those, and then over some period, you know, actually try and assist the places that aren't meeting those targets through sort of mentoring and training and that to get to the targets, rather than just saying, okay, you didn't meet the target, you're not going to get the 2.5%. CEQ surveys, which the performance funding talks about a lot as being something that's going to be used, I guess there are big problems with those surveys with response rates. That if you're going to use these surveys to have I guess, a significant amount of funding conditional on them, then I think that you've got to make sure you also take actions to get, you know, much higher response rates. Because in the past, you know, some of these CEQ surveys, it's been 10 or 20% of students who are responding to those surveys. And so you really have potential problems of selection bias in using data from those surveys. So my next set of points was, I called it policy, ideology and regulation. So, I mean, I think, so this budget proposes a new type of university regulation. I think that there's a genetic test for whether you're going to be a politician or not. It's whether you believe that there are adjustment costs. I think the great conceit of politicians is to believe that it's always best to introduce a new system, that it's not going to be satisfactory, and guess it's a clean start and a new system. And the problem is for, you know, I guess for people who are working in those systems, that involves huge adjustment costs. And so I guess it's a general sort of comment that I think continuity is in most cases better than, you know, holeless, bolus sort of new systems of regulation. The other thing that's sort of amazing when you know, I can remember when I was studying economics at VCE and the budget then, like the budget, you'd read it and everything was there in real detail and it only told you about the next year sort of, that this is all we're doing, this is what we're doing this year and that's that. I mean, when you read the budget now, like, they're telling you what they're going to do for the next 4 years. And, you know, I mean, I know it's heresy at University of Melbourne to suggest that Kevin Rudd won't be the Prime Minister for a very long time in the future. But it has to be said that there's one more election sort of before 2011-12 and 2010-11. And the government's sort of committing this expenditure to a period when they may not even be the government sort of. So I think, you know, budgets have really become sort of a lot more speculative than they used to be in terms of, and, you know, most of the goodies in this budget are actually promised 3 or 4 years out sort of. So I think there's a real issue when you look at this budget in terms of the credibility of whether these promises will actually be sort of delivered on. And so much of the budget's sort of a black box as well. Like, it says, oh, we're going to have performance funding, but nowhere in the budget does it talk about what that performance funding is going to involve. It says that we're going to have partnership agreements between universities and you know, potentially schools with low SES students to assist increasing percentage of low SES students at university. There's one line in the budget which talks about sort of, or in the document, which talks about things that might involve doing. So this is sort of very much sort of a black box, a budget document. The other, I'll skip the next point because I don't have long left. The other thing which, I mean, yeah, I guess this is tilting at windmills because I think it's a battle that's lost, but it's something that I just don't understand. I mean, I think which is the role of sort of private education. I mean, I think when we had the last education minister, well, when you had Brendan Nelson as education minister, the problem was he wanted to refight his student politics battle sort of by getting rid of the student amenities fee. I think the problem at the moment is that Julie Gillard and Minister Carr, they sort of want to refight their student politics battles by not having domestic full fee paying places at universities. And, you know, like, I'm a big supporter of sort of like private schooling or anything like that, but it seems to me I just can't understand the intellectual consistency of providing large amounts of government funding for private schools at high school level and then saying that at university level we're not going to allow sort of in any sense that people to sort of buy places or to have sort of a differentiated system. So I guess, and yeah, that's something that I guess, again, you know, reduces funding to universities. So I think that, yeah, there's an inconsistency in that. Another, I guess, key thing is this idea of a demand-driven system. So the idea is that, look, people have these vouchers essentially and they'll be able to take them where they want. And so that demand will drive sort of extra places at universities. The problem is that we know that sort of in most markets, it's not just demand that determines the outcome, it's supply as well. And so if you think from the point of view of universities, if they're interested in not losing money, then presumably the number of Commonwealth supported places offered is going to depend on the price which is being paid for those places relative to the costs. So you'd only provide the place if you covered your costs, if you were interested in not losing money. And you'd only provide the place if that didn't crowd out offering the same place to another student, e.g. international full fee paying student, from whom you could get even more revenue. And so you have to regard a key aspect of the current system as being the continued lack of scope to adjust prices. And so here I've quoted Simon again, so you have to slash this slide out of your talk, Simon, sorry, that a likely consequence is, and this is from Simon's article in the Australian Financial Review, when you put those two things together, a likely consequence of this introducing vouchers but not changing prices at all is going to be continued high numbers of international students in prestige institutions while growth in local participation takes place in less research-intensive private providers. The other point I've got to make is just about this point about improving access for disadvantaged students, which is obviously an extremely sort of important goal to have. But there are some issues about the way it's formulated in the budget. One point which Andrew Norton has made is that there's an issue about saying that the way the target's expressed is that it says we want 20% of students to be from low SES backgrounds. Now, at the moment, low SES is defined in terms of geographic region that individuals come from. And as Andrew pointed out in his talk a couple of weeks ago, you can actually have different numbers of population in low SES regions versus high SES regions. And so you could sort of imagine potentially over time a shift where there were less people living in low SES regions, more people living in high SES regions, which would actually make it sort of more difficult to achieve the target of 20% of all students coming from low SES backgrounds. So Andrew actually suggested that a more reasonable way to think about this target might be to have a target for the percentage of people from low SES background who are at university, rather than having a target which is in terms of the percentage of low SES students as a proportion of all students. Another question is just how we can best promote participation by disadvantaged students. So the budget is very explicit about saying that universities sort of, I guess, should have a role in doing this by putting pressure on secondary school system in terms of standards and that. Also, I guess, a lot of attention to income support. The best work that I know of sort of on participation by groups from different SES groups is the work by Chris Ryan and Bully Kardak from a few years ago, where they showed that conditional on having an ENTA score and conditional on having the same level of ENTA score, whether you're from low SES background or high SES background, had no effect on your likelihood of being in university. So in other words, income factors, given that you already had an ENTA score of a particular level, had no effect on the likelihood of participating at university. Rather, what they found was that it was actually your performance at year 9 in sort of standardised aptitude test, and then the way you translated that performance into whether you got an ENTA score and your level of ENTA score that matters. So it seems like, you know, the big issues we need to be addressing, and obviously this fits in sort of internationally with work that people like James Heckman have been doing, the way to best promote participation is not by fiddling with income support for university students, it's by doing things back earlier in the primary and secondary school system. And so that gets me to the final point, which is, you know, what can universities sort of do in that regard? You know, is the $400 or whatever million dollars that's proposed for universities to help improve participation by low SES secondary school students, is that money well spent? And I guess I don't know the answer to that question, but it does seem like it's sort of an extra activity that universities are being asked to do that they don't do at the moment, that I guess you wouldn't necessarily regard universities as having a comparative advantage in, but I guess the government obviously feels that the universities may perhaps, if they create this target of 20%, the universities then will become sort of a voice that will create political pressure backwards to make changes to the system. But I don't necessarily know whether that means that universities should also have a role in sort of doing the improvement sort of performance. That's it.
Thanks very much. It's very nice to see you all. And I do apologise for not being Michael Gallagher. It would have been a very interesting talk from Michael. And I'll do my best to not substitute for him, but to add something to the important points that Jeff has made. This was an important budget, and I think the fact that there are many of us here tonight reflects that. Not only was it a response to the Bradley and Cutler reviews, but in a larger sense, this was the first indication of what the education revolution meant for tertiary education. And this budget's decisions came in on the back of a considerable momentum that had built up for reinvestment, which had been really building over the period of the Howard government since backing Australia's Ability, which was a substantial contribution the Howard government made in 2001 to basic research. There really hadn't been anything much. And Rudd government came into power really on the expectation that it was going to reinvest in tertiary education and indeed in schools. While it's done so to some extent already in early childhood and begun to do so in government schools, the test in tertiary was this budget. And the pressure was on the government not just to spin the issue, but to really do it, to really invest seriously and to bring in a new policy framework. And the four-year span of the financial announcements indicated the government did want to see this as a watershed, did want to lodge a new policy, and did want to make that stick over the four-year period. I want to just reprise, though, on our seminar of 2 years ago, when the Rudd government was not in power and when we were looking at the possibility of a change of government, I think, and see what then seemed to be the challenges for policy. And this I'm going to use as a measuring stick to assess this budget, this and the following slide. The challenges, were firstly that the comparative international framework had become central to governments in the way they looked at higher education and research policy, that they were increasingly looking at the global standing of their institutions and their research effort, their participation rates, and other indicators. Secondly, the challenge was there, I think, to develop a proper understanding of the knowledge economy, the kind of issues that Jeff's talked about, where investment in education and research fits into the larger process of national development. Thirdly, there was a particular problem in that area to undo, which was the way in which the tremendous growth of the export market was being driven not by the quality of the system, but by its underfunding, which was forcing institutions to maximise export volume rather than the quality of students or necessarily the strategically appropriate international connections. And we needed to reset that pattern of incentives and connections between the export sector and the quality of the domestic system. The policy culture itself had degenerated considerably. I think there was a view in 2007, think about whether it's still true, that everyone who spoke on university policy or research was purely pushing their own barrow, that they were pursuing their own interest. There was little talk of the long term of the national interest in a serious way, except as a rhetorical gesture from time to time by everyone. In other words, there's no real discussion going on about where we were heading in the larger picture. And federal-state relations were clearly, they didn't just need to be reconstructed, they didn't exist in education and training by 2007, which is one of the reasons why VET funding was in such a bad state. More specifically, the policy problems, reinvestment, regenerate basic research, and I'll come to that in detail in a minute, fees, loans, HECS, student assistance package didn't make much sense. You had domestic fee charging alongside HECS places. You had differential rates for HECS for different disciplines, which seemed quite extreme in some respects. You had the schmozzle over nursing and teaching, where incentives designed to build those areas were actually reducing enrolments. And of course, the disjunction between domestic fee arrangements and international fee arrangements. And so all of that remained to be sorted. The domestic participation in the period of the Howard government really was not an issue, was allowed to slide as an issue in Australia, and there was little focus on equity, although in a curious way there's probably more interest in equity issues in Canberra than there was in actual overall participation. The issue of diversity was before everyone. We were all talking about the problems of a one-size-fits-all framework and the need for more variety in mission, but the Howard government had been unsuccessful in creating a set of incentives that would encourage that. Our global engagement was primarily focused on the export market with insufficient attention to, at a policy sense anyway, to research linkages and other non-export issues. That was all being left to the institutions, who themselves were largely focused on building exports, which isn't to say it's the only thing they've done internationally, but in the last 10 years or 15 years, but certainly in Australia, it's been a more important aspect of international mission than it has been in any other single country in the world. And that was a product of particularly the post-1995 fiscal framework. Problems of standards were emerging in many quarters for many people, especially in relation to the export market, and the state of government institution relationships was poisonous. And the lack of a buffer body was what many people were pointing to, the need for something like the old Commonwealth Tertiary Education Commission to handle the longer-term planning issues, to make apportion decisions between institutions and parts of the sector in a way which would be more dispassionate and less tied up with electoral politics, for a start. I'm going to talk about some of these issues, the ones in yellow principally. Just to briefly touch base on public investment, and Jeff's made some good points already. The points I'd emphasise quickly are, we have a change in regime in that the government's committed to shoring up indexation of basic government grants for teaching, and also in establishing a full cost research funding regime so that we're comparable again with Canada, US, UK. And that's good policy, but it pulls us back to where we were in the mid-90s before Simon Crean, as Minister for Education, introduced partial indexation and created that incentive to grow international year by year to fill a growing cost gap. But the return to a sensible policy, because that's all it is, it's not a spectacularly generous one, it's a sensible policy and an internationally comparable one, is going to take place over quite a long time span. 6 years in the case of full research funding, 4 years for indexation. Participation is not being funded at cost. In most disciplines, the rate of funding for government places is now considerably below actual cost, and so domestic student places have to be subsidised from international student fees, because that's the principal non-government market area of income. That's at this point unchanged, because the 10% decision was not made. Bradley's recommendation to increase funding rates by 10% was not implemented. There will be a funding review, though, of the cost of those places. That will report in 2011, which then means we're really in the present situation of funding domestic places under cost for the next 3 years at least, and with full indexation coming back slowly too, that the underfunding actually gets worse before it gets better. Jeff cited my calculation that I think that in the fourth year, 37% of the Bradley funding comes through. That's all it is. So when Paul asked the question, was it all too good to be true, that first two or three days of euphoria, which I think was being driven mainly by Education Investment Fund decisions that particular universities had won, the answer is yes, it was all too good to be true. The spin had taken over, and it wasn't as good, in fact. And the fact that it wasn't as good as it looked, and the fact that we're only getting 37% of the Bradley funding, which was not excessive, not particularly generous at the time it came out in December last year, haven't things changed since December, means that it's not in fact a fundamental shift in terms of dollar amounts. The shift that is occurring, though, is the restoration of indexation and the introduction of full research funding, and that will make a difference longer term, but well down the track. Let's have a look at research. The core problem here is this. We're not internationally competitive with the best OECD economies in research, put it bluntly. We're a middling power, and we're slipping, I think, if anything. And the international comparative data, which I'll give you a bit of here, I think confirms that. And the Cutler report on innovation system had a clear warning on this, but it's in Annex, in one of the annexes. It's in Annex 6, and it found its way into the main report a little, but it was a very important statement, and I'll give you it because you won't have seen it. Cutler said that, pointed to the fact that around the world there are major investments in innovation capacity going on. These are particularly centred on basic research in universities and also on the funding of linkages between universities and industry. They're in continuity with the policy regimes of the last 20 years in the focus on links to industry, but the emphasis on investment in basic research is substantially new. The US, of course, never stopped investing in basic research, and some of the European countries, such as, for instance, Switzerland or Sweden, didn't either. But many countries shifted resources out of basic research and into fostering applied and commercial, or into away from research altogether. In other words, followed the Thatcher 1980s research paradigm, that the problem was that there was all this knowledge which wasn't being used, and the real important issue was to try and pull the university research into a direct role in innovation, with commercialisation as always the objective. Policy paradigm is now on the nose. There's a recognition that innovation occurs in much more complicated and diffuse manner. The main role of universities in an innovation system is to pump out open science into the innovation environment, and for which companies will then source as they see fit as time goes on. And so the important thing is, in fact, to maximise the quality of that basic science and its accessibility to dissemination. The basic science that a national corporation framework will use will be from all over the world. It won't just be from the national innovation system, but the national innovation system needs to create the capacity to understand that science in the companies and in government, and can only do so by maintaining a strong engagement in the basic research areas and a strong research training effort. Hence, back to university basic research funding, back to the paradigm of the 40s, 50s and 60s, in fact, in relation to basic research. That's where the world's going. And Cutler pointed out that not only is the US back on the basic research trail, and Obama said that he'll double National Science Foundation and other funding as part of the stimulus package, double it. But China, of course, has been investing at almost 20% per year increase in R&D. The scientific publications in China have doubled in 10 years. South Korea and Singapore exhibit almost as spectacular a rate of growth of investment in basic research. And Taiwan, China is the other. So the Asian tigers have become innovation tigers, and they're racing away. The other zone of interest here is Europe, where the Lisbon target is for 3% R&D as a percentage of GDP, 3% of GDP on R&D. While not all countries are going to reach that, and clearly the recession is going to impact that target as well, a number of important European science sectors are on that road or already there. And the rate of R&D funding and the rate of university research funding is considerably higher in Scandinavian countries, Denmark particularly, Sweden, Norway, Finland, Netherlands, Belgium, than Switzerland, than it is in Australia. And Germany, of course, is now coming back into the picture. Having underfunded research within a neoliberal fiscal framework for 20 years, Germany is now putting money into additional research funding into selected universities. I think we'll see in the next generation the rise of or re-rise of German universities. Very important worldwide development. Intellectual powerhouse again, I think we'll see. And, of course, France has got this €4 billion merger programme, which is designed explicitly to bring French universities up the Jiaotong research ranking. So it's all happening, folks, but it's not happening here yet. But Cutler was onto this and said to us, look, if we don't do this ourselves, we're going to fall further behind. Our competitive position now is that we have 10 of the top 100 discipline groups in the Shanghai Jiaotong Index. And we won't go into the strengths and weaknesses of that index, but it's a reasonable measure, I think, for this purpose of at this point of time. You might quarrel with the inclusion of Nobel Prize indicators, but the other indicators essentially are solid, comprehensive research measures of citation and publications. The fact that we've only got 10, perhaps, is only because Canada has 26. The Netherlands, which is got a smaller country than us, has 15. Israel, which is a much smaller country than us, has the same number of top 10 groups as we have. Our top 10 groups are in the case of ANU, in the top 40, two of them. And Melbourne also has a good spread with social science just below the 100 mark as well. And we hope it'll be back there. But Sydney's performance is disappointing. Only one top 100 group on a world scale in engineering. New South is in the same position. Queensland's on the up. But these data are basically early 2000 or late 90s citation data. So there are more recent data, and the Leiden research indicators provide that. This is the best data set, I think, at the moment for comparative purposes. Leiden has been specialising in measurement of research publication and citation performance for quite a long time. And they've got a very good journal set, much stronger than the ISI, Thomson ISI base that Jia Tong uses, or the Scopus one that the Times Higher Education Supplement use. And they also normalise the field so that they deal with the fact that in, say, medicine, for example, people cite at a much higher rate than they do in engineering. They've accounted for that, and so they've got field normalisation data, as they call it, which essentially means that you level the playing field between the disciplines when you do the numbers, which is good, and they've done that well. Now, these three columns tell us different things. The first column of figures tells us about total publications. This is an indicator where Harvard is almost double the rest of the world, and where the University of Tokyo is second, and the University of Toronto in Canada is third because it's so very big. And on that indicator, Melbourne is in the top 60, and Sydney's even higher than Melbourne. It's at 52 because it's a larger university. But that's just publication numbers without any measure of quality. The second column gives us total publications, but then modified for the rate of citation of those publications. So it's a quantity measure then qualified by quality. And it's also been field normalised in that case. And what this gives you, I suppose, the best measure we currently have of raw firepower in the knowledge economy globally. And the good news is that Australia has three in the top 90 on that indicator, but, not in the top 50. The third column is the quality measure. It's citations per publication. And there, our performance is frankly disappointing. ANU's at 120, whereas on all other indicators, it's the quality, it's usually higher. On this is probably the best quality measure we have, but it's at 120. And Melbourne, Sydney, Queensland are limping along in the top 200. This indicator is a little bit misleading in the sense that the sheer weight of the American university system and the fact that Americans cite Americans and often don't cite anyone else tends to create a kind of reproductive effect. The first 36 universities on this indicator are American, but you can't get away from the fact that this is citations per publication. This is an indicator of what's read and what's used in that sense. We're paying the price of the shift from basic research to applied research focus. Applied research doesn't generate the same level of scientific publication, raw science, that can be used for a range of purposes. That table, which has been pinched from Michael Gallagher's pre-budget presentation to the Fin Review conference in February, shows that the proportion of Australian university research activity that's basic research, classified basic, has gone down from 77% to 50% between 1969 and 2006, which is a really quite a substantial shift, one of the biggest shifts of its kind in the world. Now, what's happened in the budget? Well, I mentioned full research funding will be phased in over 6 years. I mean, it's a very long time span, but, nonetheless, this is an important decision. The principle has been established, and I think it'll be difficult, although not impossible, for treasuries to undermine this decision and renege on the transition into full research funding. It'll be difficult, but not impossible. So it'll be necessary for the university sector to sustain the argument over a six-year span, but it's there, so far anyway. There was a bit more in the budget than that for research. There was also the super science initiatives, which really fall in three broad discipline areas. There was nothing in terms of across the board increases in basic research support. What was missing was Australian Research Council fund increase. In fact, the rumour went round the week before the budget came down that ARC was going to be cut, which would have crueled the relationship between the government and the sector, but it didn't happen. And there were a lot of rumours before budget, so, you know, we don't know whether it was going to happen or not. The fact that ARC Discovery Grant success rates are now around about 20% and falling is a bad sign. It means that it's become very difficult to access the basic research system, and maybe another 20% ought to be funded but aren't being. And so we're back to where we were before backing Australia's ability, which was, you know, where the 20% was seen as the sign that the system had degenerated too far. Just to briefly touch base, and Jeff's covered some of this, you know about the 40% target, the fact that the government intends that by 2025, that 40% of people in the 25 to 34-year-old age group will be degree holders. And also government intends that by 2020, which is 5 years earlier, 20% of students in higher education will be from the bottom quartile in an SES sense. The measure of that is yet to be determined. We presume it won't be the postcode measure that's been used up to now. The funding rate is too low. The situation is that, as Jeff said, institutions have a disincentive to enrol domestic students at the current rate of funding below cost. And so, given that they're essentially now setting their own enrolment levels, many are likely to be reluctant to expand to accommodate more domestic students. Those that do will probably be the new providers who are trying to build their role in higher education, such as some of the vet providers that offer degree courses, the private sector particularly, and perhaps some of the regionals and some of the lesser lights in the system that need to build volume and perhaps can operate are prepared to operate at a lower level of cost. But it really puts the squeeze on those who don't have the best income earning opportunities through other means, but can't really afford to seriously expand domestic participation at these funding rates. And it's the middle players, it's the innovative research universities, it's some of the ATNs. I mean, they're placed in a very difficult position, I think, with some big choices about where they jump into trying to work the system to get some economies of scale through while expanding domestic enrolments, knowing that that'll push them into very large numbers and difficult to manage and difficult to service, or trying to stay at their current levels, refusing the offer that the government creates of a new wave of funding, with the danger that the domestic funding will be improved out of the review of funding rates, and they'll be left out of the new era, and out of favour with the government as well, and with that reflecting on them in compact negotiations. So it's some difficult strategic time. Diversity, I don't think we've changed the system setting sufficiently to say that we can develop more nuanced missions. The key issue really is that there's no basis whereby the serious global research players, which in the first instance are probably those who are listed in the Leiden figures, the G of 8, but some others as well, I think. Those serious players, how can they build their global position in terms of research funding and research activity, given that there's nothing like the American system, which provides full fee avenue to build resources with. There's nothing like the British system, which provides large amounts of money tagged to research only, allocated on a differential basis on through quality, the research assessment exercise. So we've got neither the British way of building research competitiveness nor the American way, neither substantial research-only funding nor the freedom to deregulate and charge domestic fees at whatever level the institutions like. So neither of those avenues are available. So the would-be serious research players are really going to be struggling. They've got a glass ceiling, in effect, and they can't build their international position. I think they have to go backwards under the current settings in the longer term, given the way in which these other countries are seriously building research capacity through direct investment by governments that don't have any problem in giving it out to their best research centres and their best institutions. We can't do that under these settings. So that's one kind of diverse mission. The other kinds may be things like regional role, relationships with VET, and between VET and higher education institutions, a special role in relation to equity. Those kinds of missions, I think, are there within the settings, but they don't really substantially shift around the political economy of participation rates, domestic and foreign students, and so on. And everyone, I think, is still locked into having to build the high volume international enrolments because the domestic funding rate is below cost, and so you've got to make up that gap. You've got to subsidise it from somewhere, and international students are the way to do that. Really, just to close, let's just quickly look at what's there about quality and standards. The significant move, of course, is to establish the Tertiary Education Quality and Standards Agency. This perhaps is the buffer body which we've needed in the system to manage its longer-term development. It's unclear as yet how it will work, who will be on it, what kind of powers it will have, how independent it will really be, whether it will have a data-gathering capacity. It's not going to administer funded programs in the way that the old CTEC did, but its regulatory role in relation to accreditation and standards becomes quite an important role. And the government's concern to, I think, to persuade us that the TEXER is not going to be highly intrusive and wrap us all in red tape. Nonetheless, all of that remains to be seen, I think it's fair to say. It looks likely that TEXER will have a significant role in relation to performance indicators and to developing the new system of performance-based funding that Jeff referred to. And that certainly has been set aside as one of its possible tasks, one of its necessary tasks, actually. It will be looking at outcomes measures and developing metrics around them. But it's not quite clear that TEXER is going to do this because there's two different statements made in the main budget statement. One is the statement that TEXER will take the lead in coordinating this work and establishing objective and comparative benchmarks of quality and performance. The agency will collect data, it'll monitor performance and so on. So that's said on page 31 of the main budget statement on tertiary education. But right at the back, there's a discussion of compacts, which are individual negotiations with each institution, which presumably will be carried by the department, although that remains to be absolutely clear. And compacts will be part of a process of setting performance indicators and performance targets and managing those. And compacts will partly be around how institutions are going to achieve these targets. Now, it may well be that I'm being overly suspicious here and that, you know, these sets of forms of words are reconcilable and TEXER is going to do the thinking and the department's going to carry out the negotiations at the compact level, but I would have thought that even so, that would probably weaken the role of TEXER if that's the case. So it's not quite clear to me yet anyway, and perhaps it's not clear to any of us, exactly how much independent role TEXER is going to have, how much the department is going to give up its current more direct and arguably more intrusive relationship with the institutions. I think it's early days yet on all of that. And of course, it's early days yet in terms of where ORCA goes in relation to the standards and quality issues, to what extent its functions are folded into TEXER and seen as part of TEXER, to what extent this is a post-ORCA regime, to what extent it's a regime which is essentially in continuity with ORCA. So in summary, government's made a start on some of this, I think. The commitment to investment levels remains the key issue, and it has to be said that things are disappointing so far. And the problem of basic research hasn't been grappled with in a serious way yet. There's a little bit in the budget. And the decision to introduce full research funding is a significant one. But it's well down the track, and that in itself just gets you up to first base, really. Student assistance package was a major step in terms of the position of students, but the rationalisation of HECS levels and fee levels perhaps still to take place. We wait on the rate of funding of places. That's a crucial decision, and that those recommendations or that review will be announced in 2011. Domestic participation, back on the agenda. Clearly a major priority of government. This has changed things considerably, but the funding rate remains a crucial barrier to the implementation of that promise. So that, again, that review of funding rates in 2011 really is quite a pivotal part of this whole package. Diversity, well, I think the uniform settings have essentially been maintained. the fact that you've got that all institutions are locked in, apart from ANU, which has special research funding, are locked into high volume international enrolments is quite important in that regard. I mean, you'd like to see a situation where some institutions are specialising in the export market at that level and others free to nuance it a bit. Narrow global engagement. There are the fact that in the medium to longer term, institutions will not have to keep growing in international. And remember, some of them have, something like, I think 15 of them have more than 8,000 international students, EFTSU. And there are several with well over 10,000. It looks likely that they'll be able to stop growing in that 3 years' time. That might help us get to a more nuanced and more complicated international engagement. But it was disappointing that the budget decided not to adopt the Bradley recommendation on 1,000 scholarships for international PhD students. That would have been a good move forward, and we hope that that'll come back on the agenda. But, you know, it was really left up in the air in the budget announcement. On the issue of standards, clearly there's a potential to develop that issue, and much thinking needs to go on there on how that should be managed, and perhaps the government-institution relationship, which is already, I suppose, benefiting from the fact that this is no longer the Howard years. We're in a new regime. There are still positive feelings and expectations about the relationship in the sector, and perhaps in the public mind, the Rudd government will be seen as a pro-education government, still, I think, pretty strongly so. All of that is positive and favourable, and the potential to develop a buffer body around TEXA is, again, a positive development. But one gets the sense that we've got a way to go. We haven't got serious about global comparison yet, except in relation to participation rates, which was Denise Bradley's emphasis. The notion of the knowledge economy is still, I think, special pleading in the mouths of vice-chancellors. It hasn't become a serious way of thinking and looking at national economic and social policy. We've begun to unpick the mix of incentives that was driving extreme export sector growth at the expense of quality. We've begun to unpick that, but we haven't got a new set of incentives which are stable and long-term. You'd like to see a situation where both export quantity and system quality are working with each other rather than against each other, that they're working in tandem. That's the set of incentives we need, but we haven't got there yet. The public policy culture, I don't think there's any real change there. Unfortunately, we've now got what appears to be a long-term policy but isn't, and that hasn't helped us get to a real one. But maybe TEXA can help in developing a better environment. And on federal-state relations, well, the circumstances are favourable. The governments can talk to each other at the moment, but not much is happening, and not much progress was made on VET and higher education relationships in the budget, which was disappointing because it looked like Bradley was going to address that. I think most of the issues have been opened up, but not research. Basic research and our research position worldwide is the neglected area that really matters, and we really need to get to grips with it. The Rudd government, I don't think, has settled the issues, and this was a short to medium term political fix rather than a serious long term policy framework, although there are some moves in the long-term direction with the participation targets and this creation of TEXA. The momentum for transformation, though, has been lost. This is a serious political problem for those of us who want to advance the knowledge economy in Australia, and will have to be rebuilt. And to rebuild it, we're going to have to sweep away the spin, which says that was a good budget for higher education. I think it was 50-50. And it's a platform to go forward, perhaps, but the work still has to be done. Thanks.
Simon, that sounds like possibly 2 cheers for the budget from Jeff, 1.5 cheers from Simon. I don't know about the rest of the audience. I mean, what they've picked up on are some key issues, I think, and one is the fact that although there is a commitment on the part of government for an education and a higher education revolution and a commitment to invest, the government is trying to construct a sort of balance, I think, in the budget between the goals of participation and research excellence. That's, in a sense, it's about does the government invest in human capital in terms of breadth, lots of participation, or depth, going for the excellence in research? And I have to say that I think the sort of evidence from Claudia Goldin and Lawrence Katz on the US actually leaves open the issue as to whether you get more bang for your buck by going for breadth in terms of participation or whether you go for excellence in a narrow area. It's a bit like a government saying, should we want to do something to for this nation, should we invest in the fitness and performance of our Olympic athletes, or should we have a program for improving the health of the general population? You can spend money in both directions, have very different outcomes. Both sets of outcomes may be worthwhile. It depends what you're trying to achieve. And actually, I think economists can't deliver as yet really good answers as to say where the best return comes. It's also just taking one of Simon's points, which I thought was very important, that participation is not funded at cost in this budget. I think that's absolutely true if we think about participation in the university sector. But it is clear that there are many other operators, particularly TAFE, in the vet sector, particularly TAFEs, for whom the current level of funding for degree-level education probably is above cost. TAFEs will always be able to offer degree-level programs at a lower cost because they don't have a research infrastructure and research staff to support. And one obvious move might be for the government to seek to reach its participation target in terms of bachelor degree, the proportion of the population holding a bachelor's degree by 2025, by promoting a very large expansion of non-university degree-level education at a much lower price. That's certainly a possibility. But now for observations and questions from the floor. The roving microphone is about to rove. So if you could put your hands up, whoever wishes to speak or comment, and if you could say who you are and keep your questions short, that would be appreciated. And I can't actually see because the lights are so bright.
Paul Hart. Connor King. I now work for Phillips KPA. I used to be a lobbyist. I was then a strategist. I'm now a consultant. Jeff, you claimed your comment would be an external commentary, but I guess after 10 years of being kind of old but outside the sector, I found it a very internal perspective on the funding issue coming from someone who works within a university. And two things I would just kind of pick up on that. The funding doesn't happen for 3 years or 4 years. Yet, I mean, as a lobbyist for ABCC, there was a standard rule that you shouldn't change anything for at least a good decade to let universities prepare for it, be ready, and then undermine it, essentially. And if you did it next year, that was outrageous. So there's a kind of contradiction sometimes universities will run here. In terms of more money, yes, we'll have it tomorrow, but no government's going to just throw it around. And I think from an external perspective, we'd say they're introducing change in 2012. Obviously, the money's not going to come until the changes are in place. Why give it now if it's only because you're just going to get used to it? The other thing, the SES issue. I find it a really frivolous argument to say that the rate could be 15, 16, 20, 10, and mathematically we can't exceed low SES if it's, you know, if it's, we can't actually reach the level that they're set because it's actually a little bit lower in the population. Yet, replace low with high, replace it with median, every university in the country exceeds the benchmarks, whatever you want to set them. So mathematically, you can do it. It's not an impossibility. It's to do with the groups and the points you came back to, who's coming through from schools and that sort of thing. But it comes down to that university assumption that the best way to select people is based upon academic capacity. There's a good case there, but frankly, people don't actually make it, don't actually think they have to make that case. And if you're wanting a universal higher ed system, which where the government's going, Paul says we could fund a range of people to provide it, you're looking at everyone almost being there. So frankly, selection becomes, in theory, perhaps a bit irrelevant. But my more substantial comment I'd like you to comment on, and Simon might have a response, I don't think student-driven is actually about markets. And so the criticism that doesn't open up the charges is not an officially valid one. It's about choice theorem, and it's used in a range of different areas in social policy. And it's not about letting people make a good profit and as the basis that people therefore getting the service they need. It's about government intervening, throwing around quite a lot of money, between $1,000 and $16,000 per student, and as part of that putting some conditions on and saying you guys fight it out within this set of conditions to achieve the best you can do with that money so that most of the people going through will get a reasonable education. yes, you could put a lot more money in. Some people get a really excellent one if they can afford it, the government will pay it. But they made a choice to say, we want to get everyone get a reasonable outcome. And that's a different system. It's not really, to me, a market, though they use a lot of market language, and I use it too when I argue for it. But I think it's actually different. And so to say, the criticism is not an open price, it's not valid. The issue that the funding may not be sufficient to make you want to be in it is a very valid one, and I agree totally it should be a bit higher. I also pick up what Paul just said, that others will get in there anyway, and some people will expand. So my real comment is about the market point.
Okay. Jeff, do you want to reply briefly?
I think if you read the budget papers, the rhetoric is about, look, we've created this system, we've got these vouchers, students can go where they want to. Well,
the minister's very clear on that.
It's essentially the learning entitlement sort of, that you've got to go where you want. But I guess my point is just that supply matters as well. You can only go where you want if the university is offering you a place. And when you don't change prices, that has a big effect on incentives to actually supply places. So my point is just that the eventual outcome is going to depend not only just on where students want to go and on having this increased number of students, it also depends on the willingness of different institutions to supply places. So.
Okay. Further comments or questions? And we can't really see you from here, so you'll have to...
I have a question for Simon, which is with his rankings. I mean, I remember 1976, Australia does really badly at the Olympics, sort of, and that galvanises Malcolm Fraser to suddenly create the Australian Institute of Sport and suddenly start spending a lot of money on elite sport. Do you think the Jiao Tong University rankings or the Leiden rankings, would it ever be the case that you looked at that and you found that, wow, 10 years ago, Australia had 3 universities in the top 100. Now, because of all these other countries spending and Australia spending at a lower rate, we don't have any universities in the top 150. Do you think it would ever get to a stage where the political economy was such that governments were so galvanised by that would induce an increase, or are gold medals more important than the Jiao Tong ranking?
The two things there, really, to... Son? Two things to comment on. One is, do rankings matter to governments? I mean, the evidence worldwide is spectacular, yes. Perhaps not the Australian government, but they do elsewhere. Ellen Hazelcorn did a study for OECD which looked at exactly... I mean, all the international agencies would like rankings to go away, and I think OECD would have been happy if the study had told them that rankings were not terribly important. But, in fact, the study told them that governments and university presidents and vice-chancellors see rankings as central to what they're doing, too much so, I think we'd all say. But my point is not so much whether it's a, not the normative one about whether it's a good or bad thing. It's just a question of whether it is a driver. It's such a visible performance indicator, so that vice-chancellors who preside over a university over a 5-year period where the ranking position declines find themselves having to account to their councils routinely, anywhere. It's a gross simplification of the quality and range of what universities do to rank them in any way, whether it's soundly like the Jiao Tong does or unsoundly like the Times does. But the reality is it's there, and it is a driver. And the evidence is also that it drives student choice as well, especially international student choice. But this, we're now in a rankings environment. We're now in a comparisons environment, not just rankings, but a range of other ways too in which we now look at universities in relation to other universities. The point, other point I want to make, though, is that I think the sporting analogy is a poor one, and I want to knock it over if I can. I think the idea that basic research is the same thing as gold medals at the Olympics is really misleading. The economic evidence on the spillovers from basic research is much stronger than the economic evidence on expenditure on higher education and the spillovers from that. I mean, higher education arguably creates public and private goods. I mean, in the economic sense. Basic research doesn't create much in the way of private goods. It creates public goods. And I think that there's, a fair degree of support for that worldwide, that view. It's an easier argument to sustain the argument for basic research investment than it is in the argument for the investment in the sector as a whole. Of course, if you take the democratic, element into account the public good value of educating a whole citizenry, that broadens the argument, and I think enhances the argument for public funding of teaching as well. I'm not arguing against that. Obviously, I've spent my whole career arguing for that. But I do want to say that I think money we spend on gold medalists doesn't materially advance our health, except the small number of people who perhaps directly try and emulate their feats. But money we spend on basic research has a range of public good benefits. In particular, you know, let's take global warming. If we spend money on global warming research, it has the potential to change the whole circumstance, the whole condition of the economy and society worldwide. I mean, the spillovers are, in all directions are considerable if that research materially advances our capacity to manage climate change. There really is no analogy with spending money on the Australian Institute of Sport at all.
Hi, Victor Del Rio. I'm a consultant in crisis management. And in relation to international students, I know there is the intention to improve the services that universities provide to international students. And there is an over-reliance on the money that international students come to bring to the Australian universities. But the reality, and I'm seeing it from a crisis perspective, now there is a crisis in terms of the services provided to international students. If anywhere I have seen first, second, third, and fourth class citizens within Australian universities. When we talk about the quality of education within universities, we talk about methods and tools that has to be adapted to the depending on the audience, on the target audience. I haven't seen any of that within universities, within Australian universities. It seems to me that there's a very Anglo-Saxon focus on whatever is done in whatever way it's done. I want to see whether universities with the money from the budget or with the internal money are prepared to do something not within 3 years or 4 years, but immediately to improve the standards of that service, because otherwise they are going to lose a big market and a good financial source of income.
There's an interesting topic to spend the evening on. Just a couple of things, really. And clearly, the budget, as a set of decisions, hasn't much directly impacted the international students' market and international student welfare, and perhaps it should have. And that's, I think you're right to bring up the issue in the context of the discussion that we're having in public now about the safety, particularly of South Asian students. My feeling about where we go on international student safety and welfare more generally, I mean, clearly, the spare kind of ESOS Act, the Education Services for Overseas Student Act approach, which has essentially minimised the pressure on providers and left provider institutions the role of managing these issues at the same time without specifying in detail why what the guidelines are that, you know, that govern their activity, has, I think, that approach has worked quite well in a lot of ways up to now. But when you have a crisis, it leaves us unequipped to deal with that crisis effectively. And when you reach a tipping point on the quality of service, you really have to address it. And I think in relation to safety and security, we are at that tipping point now. There's nothing in the ESOS Act currently that says that institutions that provide international education have an obligation to provide a safe environment. I mean, I think they all do. You know, they all carry out that notion. But that's only part of the problem. The second problem is what happens in the community. And clearly, a situation like the one that's now arisen, where I've got no doubt students being targeted, and if it's targeting, call it racism or call it something else, but it really doesn't matter what word you use. It's affecting people on the basis of who they are and how they look. I mean that requires a police and governmental response, and a concerted one. It requires resources. And all those issues have to be addressed now. And the Act doesn't necessarily drive us to address them quickly or effectively enough. So I think we do have to look at the regulatory framework. We probably have to spell out more entitlements and rights and protections in some areas that haven't been currently provided. And there are issues, for example, in the housing market, not only with safety, but with affordability and availability. But if anything good comes out of the present crisis, and you know, it's considerable, I think, worry for all of us, it will be that we will look again at the way we manage international education and manage it better.
question here, which I think will need to be the last question.
Jennifer Strauss, the Australian Federation of University Women. I'm really appealing to you to not depress me even further, because I'd felt at least that they had done nothing to improve student-staff ratios. But from what you were saying, Simon, it appears to me that your prediction is that at least until the full funding comes through, staff-student ratios will deteriorate even further, at least in some universities. And for the humanities sector, where teaching is intensive and where, in fact, the teachers are often the supervisors of research, this must have, in fact, a flow-on effect for the quality of research that's coming out of the humanities. Am I correct, or were you saying that you thought that the staff-student ratio would, in fact, get worse?
Well, I don't think the settings have changed a lot, but I think the cost pressures are tighter in the next 2-3 years than they've been, and then it starts to loosen a little. Now, how that plays out in terms of student-staff ratios is an open question, because there are, you know, a whole range of resource and strategy choices that universities can make in relation to the current, you know, funding constraints and opportunities. I mean, if you played your cards right, you could build a bigger role around equity about building school university liaison, and you could secure a proportion of that funding, which was larger than, you know, a pure per capita distribution would warrant. That way the institutions can build themselves a little. There are some opportunities in the present framework, but I don't think the student staff ratios are going to improve, and I think they're more likely to deteriorate on average than they are to hold. So, yeah, it's not great news, but, you know, we're not here to, to feel better about it. we have to try and deal with it as it is, and one of the problems about I think the debate is the way emotional management has become central to the politics. That's what the spin of the budget week was all about. Feel happy, this is good news, and we probably need to undo that way of looking at things and start to try to understand how it is, because otherwise, unless we understand how it is, we won't be able to make it better.
I'm Richard James from the CSHG, and I'd like to thank you for coming along this evening. I only want one more minute of your time, and that's so I can thank the two speakers and our chair. Jeff, thank you for your insights. I have to say, we don't think of you as an outsider. Let me congratulate you on the Harvard appointment, and best wishes for 2010. Thank you. I must say it's a joy to work with Simon Marginson. At half a day's notice, he's prepared what you saw this evening. He will say that it was built on previous presentations, but I know enough about the way that Simon works to know that he takes an original look at everything that he does. So thank you very much, Simon. And can I say, who needs Mike Gallagher? One of the negatives for me in Simon presenting this evening is that it makes it look like a University of Melbourne show. That's not our intention. The intention of this series is to stimulate debate on important public policy issues. We've ended up with two University of Melbourne speakers, as it turned out, so I apologise for that. But thank heavens we had Paul Johnson here to bring some balance to that. So, Paul, thank you for coming along and sharing, and I hope that in the future we'll be able to invite you along to be one of our speakers in a future event. Now, we're going to pick up some of those themes. On the 30th of July, Richard Tease and Peter Dawkins are going to talk about participation equity, but they're not going to take the sort of angles that our speakers have taken this evening. At least I hope they won't. We've asked them to look at the cross-sectoral issues. What do the targets say about how universities should relate to schools and to VET? And then in the third of the seminars, Alan Robson and Hamish Coates are going to pick up and try to unravel this complex beast that's called TEXA. So thank you for coming along, and enjoy the rest of this cold Melbourne evening.